Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the controversy over the so-called troubled teen industry, which has a toehold in Arizona, and what has changed and what has not in the 10 years since the Phoenix VA wait time scandal broke. But first, Arizona and other areas of the country are seeing an increase in the number of COVID cases. According to wastewater testing, states in the West have some of the highest rates. But 2024 is clearly not 2020 or even 2021, either in the severity of the virus nor in how we talk about it. With me to talk more about all of this is Will Humble, Executive Director of the Arizona Public Health Association, former Director of the State Department of Health Services. Good morning, Will.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, thanks. So what are you seeing right now in terms of what's going on now with COVID? Obviously, President Biden, we know, just had it last week. What are you seeing?
Yeah, so the best data we have these days is really just looking at inpatient hospitalization trends. You know, when people get infected these days, they are usually mostly using their home test kits. And so that data doesn't get captured. So the old days of knowing how many cases were circulating are over. But when you look at hospitalizations, there's about three times as many hospitalizations per week as there was back in May. So it's definitely on the increase compared to May. But as you said at the top, when you compare where we are now to the three-year average, we're substantially below that. So just to put it in a nutshell, we're having about 60 people per day going in, getting a hospital bed for COVID-19 right now, statewide. So when you compare that to those earlier years, that's really a drop in the bucket.
Right. Well, so does that mean then that we're really only finding out about the really serious cases? Because as you say, if you don't need hospitalization, you're testing at home. Nobody's going to know about that.
Right. So you mentioned wastewater at the top, and that's sort of that's just sort of environmental surveillance. It's not really, it's just a basic indicator, but it does match.
Will, are you still there? We seem to have lost our connection with Will Humble. We'll try to reestablish that and to go back to him when we can. Arizona is home to a number of facilities that claim to help so-called troubled teens. One of them, called Spring Ridge Academy, which was located in the Yavapai County community of Mayer, was recently hit with a $2.5 million judgment in a case brought by the mother of a teenager who spent time there. But as my next guest has reported, victims say more accountability is needed in the so-called troubled teen industry. Jared McDonald-Evoy is a reporter for the Arizona Mirror and has investigated this. He joins me. And Jared, let's start with how prevalent this industry is right now in Arizona.
It's pretty prevalent. Arizona is one of two states that kind of have some people would call the headquarters of these groups. That would be Arizona and Utah. A lot of people come from all over the country out to Arizona, in part because we have, you know, pretty good weather year round. So we have quite a few of these different facilities throughout the state, mostly centered in northern Arizona, those areas where it's very temperate most of the year. But we do have some down here in the valley as well. Arizona and Utah would be the two states that I hear about the most from people, and also where it seems to be kind of the most concentrated.
So what happens to these kids who go to these programs? And we should say not all of them are problematic, right? But some of them really are.
Yeah. And also, just to be fair, I have had some people reach out to me who had, you know, good experiences. I had one individual who reached out and said, you know, this place saved my daughter. But on the flip side of that, you have kind of an overwhelming response from a lot of people that these facilities create a kind of pressure on these teens that already have issues, whether that be they're dealing with trauma from sexual abuse, they're dealing with trauma from physical abuse, or some sort of drug dependency. And then they're put kind of in this pressure cooker of one of these facilities, and it kind of creates a lot of different types of problems.
One of the methods of, I hesitate to even call it therapy, that you wrote about is basically a bunch of teens get into a room and yell at each other the things that are wrong with each other.
Yeah. So this is called attack therapy, but each facility calls it something different. Like in the story, Spring Ridge Academy, they called it group feedback. Mm. And what that basically meant was you all kind of got in the common area, and you would say, you know, one of your people you're with that you share the facility with, you know, they didn't clean the dishes that day properly. You're going to yell at them now and tell them that they did a bad job and that they're selfish because they didn't do that. And the idea being it's supposed to kind of break people down. But this idea of attack therapy isn't based in any peer-reviewed science or literature. And it ends up being a way that a lot of these kids just take out their grievances on one another. And even some of the administrators and adults in the room do as well.
What do the companies that operate these facilities and the people who run those companies say about all this? Like, do they say that these kinds of things work?
Well, some of them have come out and said, no, we don't do this type of therapy, despite, you know, multiple survivors' claims. Others say, no, this type of therapy, it's not what it sounds like. It's not, you know, everyone just yelling at each other. It's a way for people to have this catharsis of letting their emotions out, because there's this theory that the reason these kids act out is because they're holding back everything. And, you know, this is allowing them to release and get that off their chest. But it ends up being used as a tool of certain other people, whether that's the facility or other teenagers, to kind of manipulate and abuse each other.
Am I right that there have been legal issues with at least some of these companies in the not too distant past?
Currently there's some legal issues with one of the groups here in Arizona. There's a lawsuit going through, a civil lawsuit, but there's been other types of legal issues. One of the more well-known ones is one in Maine called the Elon School. That one had a lot of legal issues come to it because it had a lot of kids that would try to run away, and some of those kids died. There's been some facilities here, even in Arizona, where kids have died, and there's been questions raised about were the faculty at fault for this, despite it was, you know, maybe the kid running away or something like that. So there's been a lot of kind of legal issues, but never anything that tends to really come of it. It's more about liability and things like that.
You had the chance to talk to a few people who had been through some of these programs. Sounds like the more problematic programs when they were kids. What kinds of things did they tell you?
It really runs the gamut, but one of the main things that you hear a lot about is things like the attack therapy. That's mm-hmm. a big thing, and that is a through line with a lot of these different groups. And they told me about how that attack therapy was something that was strongly encouraged for them to participate in. And these schools, you have levels, right? You have like phase 1, 2, 3, 4, and, you know, phase 4 being the highest, and you get more perks being at that level. You get treated better. You might get better food even sometimes. Mm. And so they've been told, you know, to progress through these ranks, you need to work in this therapy. But it's more than just that. A lot of these places have the kids do manual labor. They'll be, you know, helping build on for the facility, or they will engage in other types of therapy that are similar to attack therapy, but kind of aimed at themselves or at their parents even.
What did the people who had gone through these programs say about how it impacted them after they had left?
Yeah, all the people I spoke to said that they have, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, that they it took them, you know, years, for some of them decades, to kind of realize, oh, I was kind of programmed into this type of thinking of, you know, I need to always ask for permission to do things. I need to always be, you know, they might have issues with yelling at their partner, significant other, because they feel that that's the only way you're supposed to communicate your emotions, is by shouting it in a moment and holding it all in. And so it takes them years to kind of come back to, I would say, like a baseline of what, you know, you should be at emotionally, because for years they were kind of always at a high level of energy in their minds, of whether it be paranoid about what's going to happen to them or what someone might say to them.
That must make it difficult to have like actual human relationships.
Yeah. And one other kind of through line I've noticed is a lot of these survivors have ended up kind of moving towards the professions of therapists or counselor because they feel this kind of urge to help others that may have gone through something similar or prevent others from falling down into a path of a therapeutic model that might not be beneficial for them in the long run.
What kind of role does the state have? What kind of oversight or regulations do they have here?
So the main facility I wrote about, Spring Ridge Academy, they were a behavioral health facility. So they would be overseen by the Arizona Department of Health Services. As far as I can tell, all these facilities are kind of overseen by AZDHS and not like, say, the school superintendents or mm-hmm. anything like that, because they're licensed as behavioral health facilities. So people would make complaints sometimes and AZDHS would investigate. That led to some of the issues with the one in my story, Spring Ridge, because they were getting lots of complaints for a wide variety of issues, whether it be they weren't documenting things correctly, or they were giving out wrong documents, or children were getting injured in their care that were showing warning signs. And so the main investigative body for all these facilities is Arizona Department of Health Services. I'm still working to learn a little bit more about that and get more records out of this. But one of the issues that you cross into when looking into these facilities is you are talking about children. There's larger privacy implications right. on the records and the things that can be said.
Interesting. All right. That is reporter Jared McDonald Evoy of the Arizona Mirror. Jared, thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what a land acknowledgement really means.
If you cannot see, right, the wrongs or the things that have happened in history that harmed people, but you're just doing it performatively, there's a big disconnect on what the acknowledgement is supposed to be.
We'll hear from a local Indigenous artist on what a more expansive acknowledgement could look like. But first, we return to our conversation with Will Humble of the Arizona Public Health Association. Will, you back with us after experiencing the joy of live radio?
Yeah, live radio from Fort Dodge, Iowa.
Oh, my gosh, that's even better. So when we lost you, you were talking about a wastewater testing for COVID and how that maybe gets a little bit of what we're trying to find out, but not the whole picture.
Well, it gives you a general trend about how much virus is in the wastewater, and but really to get a handle on what's actually happening, the best data, as I was mentioning, is really emergency department visits and hospitalizations. And I was just saying we're averaging about over the last 2 or 3 weeks about 400 hospitalizations in Arizona per week for COVID-19, and about a dozen deaths per week. Almost all the deaths are among people over 70 years old, when it's been that way throughout the whole pandemic, really. So the trend line is up. It's way up from May, but nothing like, you know, what we had seen in previous summers, especially 2020 and 2021.
Is that surprising at all to you? I mean, we've heard that we're sort of counter-cyclical here in the Valley. Like in the summer and other places, people go outside, so maybe there's less spread. But in Arizona, it's so hot, we have to spend more time inside, which can lead to more spread.
Well, yeah, except this trend is, I mean, the upswing in cases is happening across the entire country. So I think what it really has more to do with is the fact that when you get a vaccine or become infected with the virus, your antibodies that are circulating in your blood have a shelf life of about 7 months. And so we see this 7 month cycle where the antibodies in the population start to drop, then people become more susceptible to infection. They get infected, and then those new antibodies last for another 7 months. So this 6 month cycle has been in place in Arizona and in the entire country really from the very beginning. And I think it has more to do with circulating antibodies than it does environmental stuff like weather.
So there's been talk for a long time about COVID sort of becoming endemic and kind of like the flu or the common cold. Is that what you're seeing now? Well, I think we have lost Will again. We'll probably not get an answer to that.
I'm here.
You're here. Okay, he's here. Great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hello.
Will, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. So, I mean, are you envisioning that COVID has sort of become like the flu or a cold now?
Yeah, well, it's endemic. It's definitely endemic now, which means that it has a seasonal presence, and that's pretty predictable. And that's what we're seeing right now is a seasonal predictable circulation of the virus. And we'll see another uptick around the holidays again. So in that sense, yes. I think it's going to continue along this 6-month trajectory. It's not, I don't think it's ever going to be like influenza, which is really just a November to March type of illness.
Yeah.
Same with regular cold viruses. They tend to be just mostly in those winter months.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. That is Will Humble, Executive Director of the Arizona Public Health Association, former Director of the State Department of Health Services. Will, thanks for your insights. Thanks for sticking with us through the technical difficulties.
Dan, my apologies. It's on my end.
No problem. Thanks, Will.
Bye.
Just a few weeks ago, the progressive group Our Voice, Our Vote launched an ambitious ground campaign aimed at getting the Biden-Harris ticket elected in Arizona in November, plus Democrat Ruben Gallego for U.S. Senate. They did it at the East Lake Park Community Center in one of a few traditionally black neighborhoods in Phoenix. The group says it'll knock on 1 million doors and organize in black communities to turn out the vote for progressive candidates. And now their leader tells us that message may hit home even more. President Biden has, of course, stepped aside, clearing the way for his vice president, Kamala Harris, to take the reins. She is a black and South Asian woman, and Our Voice, Our Vote executive director, Sena Mohammed, says that makes a difference with the so-called new American majority. She spoke more about it with my co-host, Lauren Gilger.
The new American majority, what we consider the new American majority, used to be young people, unmarried women, people of color. We actually make up 64% of the voting bloc in the state. And so for us, there's no denying that we have the power to be able to determine the future of our state. In 2020, the presidential election was decided by fewer than 11,000 votes. And the attorney general race was also decided by fewer than 300 votes.
Right.
So we really want to make sure that the new American majority is turning out to vote this year.
So we talk a lot about Latino and Latinx voters in Arizona, right? But black voters are not a huge part of the electorate here. You're arguing they can make a big difference. Why do you think that is? Because the margins will be so tight?
Absolutely. We win by small margins. Black voters in Arizona make up roughly 6% of the population, which to some sounds small, only in the abstract. For us, we know that the politicians underestimate our community at their own risk. Black Arizonans will wield a lot of power, and it's up to politicians to earn our votes.
Talk a little bit about what those efforts look like on the ground. When you talk about knocking on a million doors, focusing on communities of color, like where do you focus your efforts here in the Valley, for example?
Yeah, we are all across the state. We're in Maricopa County, Pima County, and Pinal County on the ground. Digitally, we're all across the state. And when we talk about 1 million doors, we are knocking on literal a million doors. You know, we just got done registering over 8,000 voters. We are investing six-figure investments into digital ad campaigns to elect progressive candidates, including presidential candidates as well. And we're texting and we are organizing our community this year. The stakes are really high and we have to try every tactic and strategy to ensure that we're reaching people wherever they're at.
So let's talk about the monumental shift we just saw in this race, right? With President Biden dropping out, throwing his support behind Vice President Kamala Harris, who is a black woman and a South Asian woman. What are you hearing from voters of color, from young voters so far about this change? Is this energizing?
Absolutely. The black voters that we speak at the doors every day on Sunday, we got feedback about just folks being excited about this new candidate and being more open to even hearing from us at the doors.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, they're worried about what could happen to our communities if we lose this election.
What about issues here? Like when you're talking to voters, knocking on doors, talking to this demographic of voters in particular, what are the big issues they're concerned about that go kind of beyond whoever's name ends up on the ballot?
Absolutely. That is the focus that our work is all about. Our community cares about reproductive rights. We care about immigration. We care about affordable housing and fair economy that gives us all really a fighting chance. And so all of these issues are on the ballot this year, and so much is at stake in Arizona, federally and locally.
Let me ask you about your own story and how you got into this work. You are a refugee from Ethiopia, is that right?
That is right. I got into this work in almost about 10 years now since I started doing this work in the movement space. For me, I come from a family of fighters and advocates who really were pushed out of our home country. And so for us, democracy is a right and a privilege at the same time. And it's really important to me that I exercise that every single day. And I ensure that my community's voices are heard and centered. I've done a lot of work ensuring that Black immigrants in the state of Arizona are organized and are able to see themselves as folks who are powerful enough to be able to create change and make an impact. For me, as a Black woman, all my life, I have dreamed of a day that a woman like me does become president of the United States. And with Kamala Harris' nomination, that day is really starting to feel closer than ever before.
So this means something personally to you as well?
Totally. I mean, she's a woman of color. She's, you know, obviously younger and really fits in with the New American majority, but also is showing resilience. And that's something that, you know, I as a Black woman have dealt with for many, many years. And her family comes from an immigrant background, which also really resonates with me. So making sure that we elect President Kamala Harris is going to be a top priority for me.
All right. Sena, thank you so much for coming on. That is Sena Mohammed, Executive Director of Our Voice, Our Vote, Arizona. Appreciate you taking the time, Sena.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. This spring marked the 10-year anniversary of whistleblowers shining light on long waits for veterans to get care at the Phoenix VA, as well as the existence of secret waiting lists aimed at hiding that information. Investigations revealed several veterans died as a result of this delayed care. The scandal extended to other VA facilities beyond Phoenix as well and led to more oversight of the system, as well as a plan to allow veterans to see medical providers outside of the VA if it'd take too long to see their VA doctor. There are differing opinions as to whether or not things have improved in the system over the last decade, and today we'll hear two perspectives on that. We start with Darren Selnick, a retired Air Force officer and former VA employee, including a senior advisor to the VA secretary during the Trump administration. He's also senior advisor to the group Concerned Veterans for America. And when I spoke with him earlier, I asked where he thinks the VA is now relative to where it was a decade ago and where it's been over the last 10 years.
Well, it's sad to see, but it's like deja vu back in 2014 all over again. I was part of, as being senior advisor to the secretary, I was part of making up the Mission Act and implementing the Mission Act and making sure that through access standards, which were similar to DOD's, that no veteran would have to wait too long or drive too far to get care. And unfortunately, what I've been seeing is someone who writes this stuff up is we're seeing in Phoenix and in other parts of the country where they don't actually follow the access standards. And veterans are getting delayed care, denied care.
Are you still finding that there are, for example, secret wait lists and things like that? Or is it, and I don't mean to minimize it by saying just, but is the problem mostly now that it's just taking too long for veterans to see a provider?
Yes, it is taking too long. And The problem is veterans are not being told that they are eligible, or they're trying to meet the access standards by giving veterans an appointment before the access standard and then canceling them, or never telling them that they're eligible for community care. So it goes on and on. They wait times that they post on the website are incorrect wait times because by regulation, you're supposed to calculate wait times by date of request. It makes sense. I call up, I ask for an appointment, that's when the clock starts. But they're still using the 2014 way of doing business, which is a patient indicated date or a clinic date where they say, hey, you know, you don't need to be seen for a certain amount of time, so we're not going to start calculating it. And it's the delays that kill veterans for cancer and other things.
For veterans who are trying to get care through the VA, is it kind of like what we see in many cases, especially here in Phoenix and elsewhere also, in healthcare, there just aren't enough providers for the number of patients who need to see them?
No, that's not really the problem. The problem with the VA is that they're so inefficient in seeing people. So if to do a direct comparison, I use Camp Pendleton Hospital, military hospital. And on average, in the military, they see 19 patients a day. Staff is telling me that they're down to as low as sometimes 3 to 5 patients or 6 patients a day. So, you know, if you have the staff, but you are inept in your operation, that's the problem. But even if the VA didn't have enough staff, which they do, they have like twice the ratio of staff that like a Kaiser does, then that's why you have community care. So if there is a long wait time, the whole point of the access standards is that if you have mental health or primary care and there's a wait of more than 20 days, they're supposed to offer you community care. If you have more than a 28-day wait for specialty care, they're supposed to offer you community care. Now, you don't have to take community care if you like that doctor and you want to wait longer. But the point is you should not have 3, 4, 5, 6 months. And a lot of doctors are getting in trouble because they are putting veterans in community care and then getting in trouble for it. And they're doing it because they have waits of 3, 4, 5 months.
When you talk about community care, you know, getting, you know, seeing a physician in private practice, I mean, anybody who's called to try to make an appointment will tell you they, you know, any random person would tell you that it can still sometimes take 2, 3, 4 months to see a provider depending on the specialty. So I wonder, like, yes, you know, the VA should be, according to the law and the standards, referring veterans to community care if the wait is too long at the VA. But does just referring them to community care guarantee they're going to get in any sooner?
Well, you're right. In healthcare, there's no guarantees. But what's the difference between, because I get asked this question all the time, what's the difference between VA and, you know, the private sector, good and bad from both sides? Absolutely. The difference is choice. So if I have a long wait time at the VA and therefore it's a 40-day wait and I go to the community and the best I can find is 50 days, I don't have to use the community. I can use the VA. So I have the choice of best of both worlds if I do. That's the whole point of choice. The difference, though, is if the VA provider is 60 days out, there is no other choice in that VA to find a better choice. But in the community, you can shop around. You can shop around to any provider that provides that in the network, and you can shop around and you can say, hey, I need to get this treatment. My experience in the private sector is if a particular provider has a long wait time, normally practices will offer you another provider with a much shorter wait time, especially if you tell them, hey, I need to be seen, because all doctor practices have holes in their schedule. So you can literally shop around, and I've done that myself, to go ahead and get the appointment that I want.
So given the problems that you're describing that are still within the VA, you know, a decade after this initial scandal broke, do you think that there is still a place for the VA, or do you think this country needs to sort of blow up the system of healthcare for military veterans and maybe start over?
Well, I think there's definitely a place for the VA. It just needs to be modernized. The VA is running like a 1990s healthcare system. And so who did modernize? DOD did. And so DOD has about 2/3 of its care in the community because there's just not enough, you know, retired veterans and stuff like that who use the DOD that are close enough to the facilities. And the same thing happens to the VA. The VA's mission is service-connected. It needs to focus on that and not try to do everything for everybody. When you try to do that, you don't do anything well for anybody if you try to do everything for anybody. So it needs to modernize. Bad employees need to be held accountable. And it needs the competition. It needs to know that if veterans don't like it, they can go somewhere else, and that's how they're going to improve their customers. So it's definitely a role. But veterans are not going to want to use the VA if the VA provides bad customer service and bad access, no matter how good the quality is. If you can't get it, it doesn't matter. I'm not someone who advertises to get rid of the VA. What I support, what Concerned Veterans for America support, is the Veterans Healthcare Freedom Act, which was a Commission on Care recommendation that I was on, that says veterans at all times should have the ability to pick between the VA facilities and the community care and be able to make the decision based on what's best for them.
Darren Selnick was senior advisor to the VA secretary during the Trump administration and is currently senior advisor to the group Concerned Veterans for America. Not everyone, though, shares his opinions. David Lucier, for one, has a much better view of the VA 10 years since the scandal. Lucier served in the U.S. Army Special Forces and is a member of the Arizona Veterans Hall of Fame. He's also active in a number of veterans groups and established a nonprofit called the Arizona Veterans and Military Leadership Alliance. When I spoke with him earlier, I asked the same question. Where does he think the VA is now relative to where it's been over the last decade?
We are much, much better off. The VA today is operationally much, much better than it was, say, 10, 12 years ago.
What's changed?
Well, for one, leadership. The other thing is that all the stakeholders, many of the stakeholders are involved. We got the veterans community involved. We got our elected leaders involved. We got administrators at the our local VA. And we also went to Washington and talked to the secretary of the VA about the condition and operation of our Phoenix VA.
Would you say that scandal sort of was the impetus for these changes? Like, did that happening lead to these changes specifically, do you think?
Absolutely. They absolutely did. No doubt about it. We got to a low point. You know, it's just like, you know, when you need treatment for, you know, drug addiction or alcohol, you got to hit a rock bottom. And I think that's kind of where we were. There was a lot of problems there. And so, again, stakeholders got together, hammered out what was wrong, identified those problems, and then came up with solutions to fix them. And, of course, that was mostly on the VA. It wasn't an easy journey, but it was certainly a successful one.
I'm curious a little bit about that journey. I mean, was it a straight line? It sounds like it wasn't, from rock bottom to the improvement that you're citing now. I mean, was it kind of a zigzag and a lot of maybe not consensus about what the right solutions would be, that kind of thing?
I mean, projects and initiatives and programs, they're like cash flows. They're uneven. They always are. But I think that we kept our eye on the ball. And we kept our eyes on the mission and the objective. And the objective was to bring our VA up to a standard that we could all be proud of. And I think that we've reached that, and we've been able to maintain it for several years.
So what is your experience now? You're a military veteran. When you call the VA to get an appointment or to see a provider, what is your experience typically like?
Well, typically you'll tell the appointment person or your medical team. I generally go online and I say, you know, I'd like an appointment for, you know, this, that, or the other. Then I get a phone call back. We understand you want an appointment. They confirm I want an appointment for XYZ. And then they say, well, listen, we can get you in on 20 days hence. Okay. So you go for it. But the rule is that if there's a time and distance rule. So if you're far enough away, or the appointment that you're being scheduled for is more than, I believe, 28 or 30 days out, then you have the option to go into the community for that care.
To see it like a private practice doctor.
See a private practice doctor. And so and that is just the standard. I'll call it a script, because they're very strict about that these days. And so they will say, hey, I can fit you in 45 days at the VA, or we can put you out in the community. And it's your option.
Well, it's interesting that you refer to it as sort of the script, and that they're strict about mentioning that under certain conditions you are free to go and see a community provider, because there have been concerns, and people have expressed them, that the VA is not doing a good enough job of telling veterans that if they have to wait X number of days to see a provider at the VA, that they do have the option of seeing a community provider. It sounds like that has not been the case for you.
No, my experience and folks that I, you know, engage with during the normal course of my business basically have said the same thing. Now, I'm sure that it's not 100%. no system is perfect, and trying to reach perfection in this life is a bit of a folly. So, but if we do come across those are the kind of things that everybody wants to know about because they want to fix it.
When you see a VA provider, you're offered an appointment, does it tend to be within a reasonable amount of time? Because that was one of the big problems, again, a decade ago, that the wait times were months and months. It was really, really a long time. Have those wait times come down to see particular providers?
My experience is that the not only has the wait times in the VA been reduced, and I'll tell you about some limitations on that, but generally that's true. And the private sector medical non-VA involvement, I mean, I'm the second of 11 siblings. Mm. And so I got a lot of siblings that are that do use those services, and in between just getting an appointment and then the billing is just I have sisters who spend a lot of time tracking down, billing and correct billing and getting appointments out in the community is not an easy thing to do. But I think that across the board, the VA's done better at getting their appointments filled. But again, we've got a backup system where if that's not, if that's not available, then immediately go to the community.
So you are active in a number of veterans groups. I'm curious what you hear from, other military veterans about their experiences with the VA, both positive and negative.
Like, sure.
What are people saying right now?
I think across the board, people are very positive about it. Folks like myself, now I've been there for several years. In fact, I was there when things weren't so good. And so I've seen remarkable improvements. But, veterans, especially when you get them in a group, can be pretty vocal. And they can be sarcastic, but they're about, hitting that nail on the head. And so if they have a bad experience, they'll say so. And I just don't hear very many bad experiences. It doesn't appear to be anything right now systemic. I think, we've addressed those problems pretty well. Again, it's not perfect. I get that. But it is way better than what we've experienced a decade ago.
David Lucier is a member of the Arizona Veterans Hall of Fame and head of the nonprofit Arizona Veterans and Military Leadership Alliance. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. I'm joined now in studio by the show's Sam Dingman. Good to see you, Sam. How are you?
Good morning. Mark, as I'm sure you've seen, land acknowledgments are an increasingly common presence in public spaces around the Valley.
Yeah, you typically see them maybe on a plaque somewhere, like in a park or, maybe walking around ASU's campus, right?
Exactly. And the wording varies, but their goal, ostensibly, is to, acknowledge the indigenous communities of our region.
Right. But you recently spoke with an artist who thinks land acknowledgments maybe have more potential.
Yes. Her name is Unique Yazi. She's an indigenous artist and designer. And she's also the co-founder of this organization called Cahokia PHX, which bills itself as an indigenous-led platform for creative placekeeping. And Unique recently made this short film called This Land Is Your Land. And it proposes a version of land acknowledgement that embraces a much more expansive interpretation of the land acknowledgement concept.
When I think of the word acknowledgement, I see it as more of a healing journey. Acknowledging something is the smallest step that starts you on your journey. But if you cannot see, right, the wrongs or the things that have happened in history that harmed people, but you're just doing it performatively, there's a big disconnect on what the acknowledgement is supposed to be.
Yes, there's something kind of odd about the tone of a lot of land acknowledgments, which is that they imply the presence of Native peoples as a phenomenon from the past. If we think about the kind of boilerplate land acknowledgement language that we see, a lot of it is, this land once belonged to, or
We acknowledge the previous presence of these people in this place.
It's done from the perspective of anthropology. So when
yes.
you think of how indigenous peoples or native peoples have been recorded in history, it's more from the perspective of a European stepping on and just observing or, you know, just noting certain things. And that's where those land acknowledgments are coming from.
Yes. Whereas you use language like, if I may quote, "We acknowledge today with a grateful presence the surrounding air's vital breath, the languages, culture, and ways of life born from the deserts, canyons, mountain ranges, and valleys." And as I was listening to that and watching the film, it struck me that in this land acknowledgement, you are addressing the land.
Yes.
Why is that a meaningful difference for you?
And I'm going to start crying in this one because the land is so important to indigenous people. We are so connected that our DNA and our knowledge systems, our ways of life are so connected to the places that we live. Me being Navajo, Diné from the Navajo Nation, I was taught by my grandmother, by my parents, by my community, what it means to be Navajo. And it was connected to my clanship. And my clanship, if you translate my clans into English, they are basically a description of people coming from land. And for us, it's not two separate things. We are the same thing. We live and breathe with each other and we take care of each other. I have such love for the land in a way that I love myself. And that if things are harming me in my environment, it is also harmful to the land. And so it's a very interconnectedness and it's an understanding that I've been raised with.
Absolutely. It makes me think, and again, I hadn't thought about this until we started speaking, that the tone of, again, a lot of these sort of boilerplate land acknowledgments is the language of difference. It is essentially, greetings, fellow Westerner. Please remember that different people, quote unquote, used to live here, which is completely different than what you're describing, mm-hmm. which is this holistic, circular,
yes.
connected mm-hmm. version of what the land and the people are. So is it fair to say that you envision a different form of land acknowledgement, if that's something that we're going to do in public spaces?
Yes, I do. I feel like our land acknowledgements as a modern-day people need to change to include creative people. And I really feel like through the arts, through creative power, that's where you're really going to connect somebody and make that connection in their heart. A lot of the projects that I do have the framework of understanding that we are living in a present time, but always looking for our future and leaning on the stories of our ancestors from the past.
So I'm guessing that the film would be an example of one of those projects.
Yes.
Tell me about some of the other projects that you feel like are in service of this.
Yeah. So we did a projection show, I want to say 2 years ago, that incorporated a vortex. And what I did is we hired, I want to say, 3-4 artists to paint a large mural that is now on Roosevelt and Central. It was a black and white mural. And the vision for it was that this black and white mural was going to be the shadowing and the stark contrast of our realities. Then what I did was layer it with a projection show, and I created a video that basically told the story of our existence from the moment the Big Bang happened and we all became the sons and daughters of a star. And it went through all the transitions of indigenous people being colonized to us learning, relearning our history, to us creating place now, to different protests that happened in the past. And then it went into the future, like, what are we going to do when we sit around our fires? What are we going to do when we sit together? What are we going to imagine? What else is out there?
Yeah. Unique, I have to say, you know, we started our conversation talking about land acknowledgments and plaques.
Yeah.
But what you're talking about is this multimedia experiential rumination on how one might be coming to stand at this particular spot in what we currently call Phoenix.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like,
yep.
it's so much bigger.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just very moved by the project you described. Am I capturing at all what your aim with it is?
Or? Yes, you mm-hmm. are. At the end of the day, what is being elevated and resurfaced again goes back to that healing journey. It goes mm-hmm. back to that moment in time when you decide that you need to make different choices in how you acknowledge people and the things around you and how you're connected to it all.
If you're comfortable saying, you know, when we were talking about your community's relationship to the land, you said it brings up a lot of emotion mm-hmm. for you. Could you say, just from your own experience, what emotions come up when you see a plaque at a park or, you know, one of these other versions of land acknowledgement that we've been talking about? Does it elicit any sort of emotional response for you?
No.
Okay.
That's a simple answer.
Right. And therein lies the problem, perhaps.
And the reasoning is because I know that whoever wrote that was probably not Indigenous. Mm-hmm. And whoever created the idea of it was probably not Indigenous. Mm-hmm. So what right do they have acknowledging the land? We are the acknowledgers of that land. And Indigenous people, we operate through a cyclical format and we operate in a reciprocal process. And when you think about land acknowledgments and where they're done, they're holding ground, they're holding space somewhere, but it's not necessarily giving anything back.
Well, Unique Yazi, designer, artist, co-founder of Cahokia PHX, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. A reminder, don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.